Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Daily Friend Wrap Show. I'm going to be your host for today. My name is Makoni Wagamaja, and I'm joined by Herman Pretorius to take you through some of the stories we found interesting from today's reporting. And I'll go with the first story about the Department of Health in Gauteng, which News24 describes as in ICU due to lack of internal controls. This is after the analysis of the 2024-25, so the previous financial year, audit outcomes that showed that the department received another unqualified audit outcome, which revealed that one, it's the only department with non-compliance across all areas due to a lack of internal controls. And that non-compliance included with issues regarding expenditure management, supply chain management laws and regulations, which resulted in an increase in irregular expenditure. If you think there's bad, if you think that's bad, rather, there's more. The department has been found, the Gauteng Department of Health has been found to have paid only 37% of the invoices in the previous financial year due to historical accrual. So this means that roughly 63% of those invoices remain unpaid. And according to the DA's spokesperson for health in Gauteng, Jack Bloom, the department owed a total of 8 billion rands from the previous financial year, which will have to come out of this year's budget, and that takes up about 12% of the 2025-26 financial year Gauteng budget. Herman, this is very discouraging given that just 2 weeks ago or so, we were reflecting on the anniversary of a legendary Gauteng Department of Health whistleblower who worked at the Thembisa Hospital, Ms. Babita Deokaran. Every year, we seem to lament issues of crime. We re reflect on these audit findings, and nothing seems to give. How are you considering all of this reporting?
Well, about halfway into the article, where was the point where my sort of my heart just sort of sank, and then I could just feel my chest decompressing or just sort of deflating, because the journalist writes rather astutely. In 2018, then Premier David Makura said in his State of the Province address that, quote, urgent steps, unquote, were being taken to turn the performance of the Gauteng Department of Health around. He quotes further, serious governance failures have compromised the quality of care of millions of people who depend on our public health system, especially the poor and most vulnerable sections of society, such as those who use mental health services. The Minister of Health and myself, Makura said in 2018, have jointly appointed an intervention team of public health experts and managers to support the Health MEC, Dr. Gwen Ramakgopa, in turning around the performance of the Gauteng Department of Health by attending to all deep structural and financial problems. We are confident this intervention will succeed, said Makura at the time. And then, in one short little sentence, the journalist just sprinkles some spice saying, the team was appointed in 2017, full stop. We are now 7 years later down the line of David Makura saying, you know, this will stop, this will change. And what becomes apparent is that the ANC has perfected the art of talking about problems and not acting about it. And data analysis and public opinion polling and focus grouping by the Social Research Foundation have found that one of the key problems for the ANC is that they simply aren't believed anymore when they make promises. 74% of South Africans associate the ANC with the phrase makes broken promises. In second place of that ranking, for context, was the DA on 8%. So when we look at these new claims, this time it will be different. This time we'll seriously put the right systems in place. This time the vulnerable and the poor who depend on health systems won't be disappointed. You know, the sad thing that I can't help avoiding is that companies and businesses that make these promises and don't actually deliver the goods go under. I'm not a free marketeer because I believe in the boundless nobility of the free or the private enterprise. But I believe the checks and balances in an economic system that is free is built into success versus failure, where the government, with its control over healthcare, is exempt from those same forces of accountability. So the fact that we are 7 years down the line, the fact that we are hearing such similar promises, the fact that this time these interventions will be the cure, and with murders of people like Babita Diokaran, and I hope we'll circle back to it in the final topic for today's show, it just becomes so deflating in the sense that we've heard it all before. Private businesses do not have the luxury of making these sorts of promises. And yet the public sector, more important to the poor than could possibly be imagined, gets away with these failing promises. That's what struck me about this whole problem, is the problems aren't new, the solutions aren't new. It's just the same old, same old. And if the ANC wonders why it is heading to become a 30% party in this coming electoral cycle, they should look to the fact that they've promised more than they delivered since at least the mid-2000s.
This is true about the broken promises, and that's what we've been campaigning on at the Institute, is this idea of fake transformation, right? Is that there are promises being made, solutions being offered, but those solutions don't actually go to the root of the problem. They just glaze over it, and we celebrate false metrics, these false rollouts of solutions, but nothing is going to happen. There will be no implementation. There will be shoddily constructed execution. And the journalist actually harkens back to that Makhura speech, and he says that only 3 years after that committee of experts that was put in place to assist the MEC of Health at the time, that the biggest corruption scandals, the COVID-19 scandals related to the Gauteng Department of Health, occurred, and that subsequent to that was the unfortunate assassination of Babita Diokaran. And yet, one of the MECs in Gauteng is quite popular there, Lebogang Malile, says, and I quote, "If we are talking about fighting corruption, we just can't talk about fighting corruption every time. And it is a buzzword. Everyone who wants to be relevant talks about fighting corruption. We must take action to eliminate it." So there goes the issue of promises delivered, promises unkept.
And you know what? It's not as if there aren't alternatives on the market in terms of how do we address corruption directly, and how can we address corruption and service delivery in the healthcare sector in one fell swoop. And that is, of course, the IRR's suggestion of healthcare vouchers as encapsulated in our Better Health Bill. The thinking is quite simple. Instead of resources being allocated to government officials to make mass-based calls on where people can get which treatment, and therefore that sort of filtering down towards treatment and patients, whatever remains after the patronage networks have dipped into this trickle of funding, we turn it around and we say, give patients the resources directly. If you are below a specific means, we already means test the state pension. We can just roll out that principle. If you are below a specific level of income or means by these several metrics, then the government will give you healthcare vouchers of X thousand rand a year. Instead of spending that money on top-down healthcare spending, we take it directly to the patient and their loved ones and say, you can use these resources to go wherever you need to go to get the best coverage. Now, the reason that ensures actual service delivery is because it taps into the demand that if you don't offer services, people won't choose you, so you won't get the income from that vouchers. It instills market-based competition for performers, for consumers. But it addresses the corruption point crucially because it's not funneling billions of rands to a few decision makers in a complex bureaucratic system. It takes that, breaks it down into the individual chunks, and gives it directly to the people. So there isn't the opportunity for this trickle of funding to be looted and patronaged out of existence until only crumbs and scraps remain for the patient. So it's not like there aren't alternatives. It's just that the ANC refuses to go beyond lip service in Gauteng, and that's the real tragedy.
Yeah, I think also the issue with things like health vouchers is they have real electoral consequences. And what I mean by this is if you give healthcare vouchers, for example, what you're also altering is that begging bowl mindset that election after election is used to manipulate people, right? Remember, if you don't vote for the ANC, you lose your social grant, you lose this and you lose that. But if people know that they get those health vouchers regardless of who's in charge, then they're also genuinely empowered, in a way that doesn't put them in a position of being so dependent on the government and on a specific party as their government being attached to those vouchers. So yeah, I think it's beneficial in a multitudinal of ways, but you've quite rightly pointed some of those out. So we move on to our second story, and this one is from Business Day, and it describes some of the new Code of Good Practice regulations that Minister of Employment and Labour, Nomakhosazana Mith, has recently put forward. It says government unveils major labour reforms to shield small firms. And I'm particularly interested to hear from you, Herman, because just last week you said the minister should be ashamed and not concerned, as she was expressing concern over, companies pulling out and the retrenchments that are going to follow suit. So maybe after we read the story, we learn that she has earned herself in your good graces. So it goes as follows that the Code of Good Practice on dismissals introduced, according to this journalist, the most significant changes to dismissal procedures since the inception of the Labour Relations Act in the 1990s. And I think he rightly points out that they're likely to cause more strain between the government, business, and organised labours. Some of those regulations being implemented are looking at easing the ability for small firms to conduct probations and as well as terminate employment of more senior employees in a small firm. And I quote from this quote, the Code of Conduct of Good Practice, while employees should be protected from unfair action, employers are entitled to satisfactory conduct and work performance from their employees. The code does not alter the rights and obligations created under a collective agreement. Furthermore, depending on the circumstances, an employer may not be required to warn an employee that if their performance does not improve, they may be dismissed. This may be the case for managers and senior employees whose knowledge and experience enable them to judge whether their performance is adequate, and employees with a high degree of professional skill where a departure from the high standard would have severe consequences for justifying dismissal. Some of the reaction we've received so far have been from organizations including SAFDU. Zwelinzima Vavi does not hold back when he describes these as the It says the new code removes the obligation for small employers to conduct formal disciplinary hearings, and that this is, he says, it represents a raw class warfare waged by bosses against workers. And the spokesperson for this Simunye organization, Patrick Mlaba, says that the new code makes it easier for capitalists to fire workers. A mouthful there, Herman. What are your reflections?
So I think Minister Meth deserves some credit. This is a positive change. I think her reasoning is sound, and it does remind of the pragmatism that was forced onto the National Party towards the end of apartheid. That I think it was Albert Luthuli who said that economic reality does not abide or restrain itself to political agendas. Economic reality means, can individuals use their skills, their times, their time, their resources, what they have at their disposal, to beneficiate these things so that they can become attractive as products or services for other people to buy? For example, I can make a hamburger myself, but Steers makes a hamburger better and quicker, and they make many of them. So if I were just to buy one broodrolletjie and one patty and one piece of cheese and one tomato, it just doesn't quite make sense because they don't sell buns really in packets of one. They usually sell them in packets of six or eight. So it makes sense for me, despite the fact that I can make a hamburger. If I really want a hamburger and I assess, look, my time is a bit more valuable to me spending, buying these ingredients, making it, I would rather just pop down to the Steers drive-through near me. Then what's happening there isn't that Steers is exploiting me for my money. They're not exploiting the people making the burger, because what's happening is I want a burger, Steers wants to sell burgers, and someone else wants to earn money and can make burgers. So the three of us, the customer, the employee, and the employer, get together in that little drive-through, and I get a burger. No one's been exploited if we all have equal sort of constitutional access to Section 23 of the Constitution, a fair labor practice. And that is, I think, people should understand that the idea of labor unions isn't anathema to a free market. I think we should remember that the protection of workers comes from a very noble place, especially post the Industrial Revolution, where workers were really treated as just replaceable. Oh, you died in a chimney, that's okay, we'll get another 12-year-old to go up there. It was cruel, it was inhumane. So the development of labor policy and labor unions and protections is vital. But a fair labor practice doesn't just mean that workers get to unionize, it also must mean that employers get a fair deal. And that is where this slight loosening of the rigidity of South Africa's labor regulations and labor law system is so welcome. Because if it is difficult to get rid of an employee that is underperforming, it creates a chilling effect for hiring employees in the first place. If you are hired and you don't do your job, and it was easier to hire you than it is to fire you, then there's a risk factor for the person who's employing you to go and say, look, perhaps I shouldn't hire anyone at all because it might drain my resources to get rid of people who underperform down the line. So when we talk about fairness, what Zwelinzima Vavi and what Mr. Mlaba are missing is that we live in a country where we don't have the luxury of hating the capitalists. We don't live in the 1980s. We don't live in the 1890s, where business meant barons. We live in a country where we need entrepreneurship, where we need the startup, where we need the young township entrepreneur to see a feasible route to scaling his talent for providing products and services. So to make it easier for people to lose a job for real reasons, not fake reasons, that should never be tinkered with. If you are fired for a fake reason, sue the living bejesus out of anyone that fires you for those reasons. But if you underperform, that's when this dismissal code is applicable. It is underperformance, it is pro-worker, because the majority of workers want to work, want to earn an honest living. And if someone isn't pulling their weight in an organization, it is right that they do not get the privilege of that income or that opportunity, and someone else is hired in their place or given that opportunity. So kudos to Minister Meth. I think this is a positive move, and I hope her reasoning of obstacles, distraction of attention and resources in terms of business, I hope she believes that, because it will make her someone with whom you can engage and say, Your argument that businesses shouldn't be bogged down applies to many areas. Let's look at those and get to a pragmatic solution.
I take a far more cynical view of trade unions. I think you're very generous, and I appreciate the looking back into history and the emergence of industrial revolution, how much things have changed since then, even since apartheid, right? And if you look at these regulations, I mean, they're so mild. They're barely going to have a dent. I can't believe the overreaction by these labor union organizations to even the most, immaterial, if you ask me, changes in how people are dismissed. Just look at who they target, like senior employees who the minister describes as people who will be more aware of why they're being dismissed. They'll expect it or receive it better than somebody who, is new to the job. If she really wanted to make huge instrumental changes, should also include people who are new to the job, right? Because I think that's when it's important. When you're just starting, it's to show that you really want to work and you really want
Add
to
value.
impress your boss, add value, exactly. But just look at who she's targeting in these new codes of good practice. Just tells me she's just dipping her foot in testing how far, perhaps she is, I hope she is, and how far she can go in actually implementing regulations that change how small and medium-sized firms operate in this country. But yeah, I'm shocked
What
at how quickly these labor union organizations came out to condemn even the tiniest of changes to labor conditions in the country.
and what they don't realize is that they only exist if there is something like an employed person in the country. So they should stop seeing themselves as just, we have to defend workers. They should also think, how do we expand the chunk of workers in this country? They should be pro they the employment the labor union should be the most pro job creation unit of society, and yet they're not. They're quite defensive, they're quite conservative, they're quite ancient in their way of thinking. And I don't want to give Minister Meth too much credit. You're quite right. This is limited in the scope, but it's a crack in previously impenetrable policy, that if the reasoning is there that the state can play a role in removing barriers to finding effective, cost-effective solutions, especially for small businesses, well, that crack, if we hammer at it enough, can become a bit broader, a bit wider. Next thing you know, we've got a paradigm shift. And I think what's sort of sad is that Zwelinzima Vavi was one of the great voices 10, 15 years ago, coining the idea of a hyena state, this exploitative state. And now, when the hyenas are perhaps starting to show some instinct for perhaps pragmatism is useful, no, he's got a massive problem with it. He's just writing himself into irrelevance. And there's something quite pitiable about that.
No better way of doing that than defending the ability, essentially, for big businesses to be able to operate more efficiently and better than small and medium-sized enterprises. Because the cumulative effect of these labor regulations is that they keep small and medium-sized businesses out because big businesses can afford to implement them. They're quite complex. They require a sophisticated HR machine that, as the minister says, small firms just don't have. And as you say, one of the incentives for them to seeing to it that the country engenders more employment because that means more subscriptions for them, more people subscribing to trade unions, is encouraging small and medium-sized firms to formalize. And what better way of doing that than getting rid of the regulatory burden and impediments to formalizations, many of which are within Minister Meth's control, right? So I agree, step in the right direction. And I don't want to criticize her too much because I think any small victory in that department, like you're saying, cracking of impenetrable policy, it is quite significant. So I'll give her that. Next story and last story for today is from SABC News. They are taking this from the president's weekly letter, where he says that the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council, NACAC, has recommended the establishment of an anti-corruption body. This is after it has concluded its three-year term and handed over its final report to the president. And there in the president's weekly letter, he states that the report includes a recommendation to establish a permanent, independent, overarching corruption body, and that this body will be known as the Office of Public Integrity and Anti-Corruption. Sounds so Orwellian. Office of Public Integrity and Anti-Corruption, and that its mandate must be to prevent, investigate, and remedy systemic corruption. Harman, my first question to you is, how permanent is permanent? Like, given what happened to the Scorpions, this is yet another Chapter 9 institution. Is it permanent until it has another Jackie Tulebi run in, you know, run in with a influential, high-ranking official, or does it actually stick? And do share some of your reflections, because I know you're working on an op-ed about dealing with the source of corruption, not just glazing over it, as we mentioned at the top of the show.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that politics seems to have the ability to upside down meanings. It's like, I think Ronald Reagan once said, there's nothing as permanent as a temporary government program. And here, in a way, we want to say there's nothing as temporary as a permanent fixture of integrity. Just look at, you know, the public protector and the South African Human Rights Commission. They were supposed to be, you know, these bastions of integrity, and I think we can put their usefulness kindly as being temporary. So I think how permanent is permanent? Well, that's exactly the question. It is dependent on political will. It is dependent on so many things. But what struck me from this story was, I think that the idealization of such a body, of sort of a Scorpions 2.0, I mean, there's space for it, but the idealization, the romanticization of it is, to my mind, one of the great frustrations that will stand in the way of South Africa making real progress in turning the tide of corruption. And what I mean with this is, if we look at the components of corruption and what makes corruption happen, we see sort of four things. A state with a bunch of resources, essentially a state that taxes too much, a state that allocates too much resources, a state that spends too much, a state that dilutes the decision-making of spending, of authority, of licensing, of the ability to be economically active, dilutes it to a whole bureaucratic army of officials. And then fourthly, a state with weak oversight mechanisms. Now, this entity, this, you know, Scorpions 2.0, might be the solution for point number four, I think, or part of the solution for point number four. Will it ensure that prosecutions happen faster, better, at a greater scale? I'm not sure. Will it ensure that the people listed in the Zondo Commission findings are actually prosecuted? I'm not sure. But let's give them the benefit of the doubt and says it's really effective at oversight, at finding corruption and exposing it. You've only dealt with a quarter of the problem. You're still taxing too much. You're still spending too much. And the discretion is still far too in the hands of the state. I looked at two very interesting countries who turned corruption around, Estonia and Georgia. And the common theme of how both those countries turned their corruption tide around, both of them sort of inheriting a corrupt system where, you know, bribery and bureaucratic opportunism and favor dealing, it was part and parcel of the system. In fact, in many instances, I think the Georgian traffic police makes corruption in South Africa, you know, frankly, look like a picnic. But what Georgia and Estonia did is that they destroyed the ability of the state to attract corrupt-minded individuals. As I write in my piece, I say, just like a heap of rotting garbage attracts rats, a bloated, overspending, discretionary state attracts corruption. So you can't just continually put out rat traps If you just don't do anything about the thing that's attracting the rats in the first place. And what is quite exceptional about what happened in Estonia is these writers who wrote a wonderful book about Estonia, Mitchell, Birke, and Zhukov, wrote with government officials having less say over who could buy and who could sell, government officials were less likely to be bought and sold. If you're going to privatize SOEs, and you force those SOEs to become companies that must perform in a market or die, that must offer a good or a service at a competitive price and provide profit and provide income and revenue to sustain its own operations, and it can't rely on another few billion rand bailout, then you're going to force those SOEs to root out corruption because they simply can't afford it. In procurement, if you are going to say, look, we're going to allow rigged procurement processes, it's not going to be based on value for money. It's going to be based on arbitrary decisions of race, of BE at various levels. Well, then you just invite corruption. That's the rotting garbage that attracts the rats. And in Estonia, what was fascinating about that is in 1998, Estonia ranked 26th on the anti-corruption index. So they were on at 26 and we were at 32, roughly, comparable in terms of position in global rankings for corruption. Today, they are 14th in the world and we are in the 70s. We have, over the same period, chosen two diverging paths of dealing with corruption. The one went after the source, after the driving factors, after the garbage that attracts the rats. And the other one, South Africa, just tries to put out new rat traps every now and again. Until we are serious about removing what attracts the rats, the ability of a state to overtax, overspend, and too much discretion for government officials up and down the system, well, then the sad thing is, Babita Deokaran, Clute Marie, Thomas Marie, Boer van Niekerk, that the list will keep on growing because corruption isn't the disease. It is a symptom of a bloated disease of government. So when NECAC comes with these ideas, it's part of the solution. But until we convince ourselves of the truth that corruption is a crime of incentive, we won't be able to actually stamp out the rats and make sure that corruption is a thing of the past. And perhaps the last thing, Georgia had a vehicular licensing system that was so complex that there were about 900 types of licenses. And every type of license had a little bureaucracy attached to it. And every bureaucracy had the incentive to say, oh, you want to run this business, you need that license, how much is it worth for you? They cut the number of licenses from 900 to 150. They cut the size of the traffic police. They did the right thing by cutting down the bloatedness of the state, and that weakened the magnet for corruption. Unless we do that, the kill list of those murdered in cold blood by corruption will grow. And it'll be to the tragedy of all.
Few words jump out to me just listening to you describe those institutional reforms that are necessary to actually change and target the sources of corruption, prevention and preemption, right? And whether this organization will be given enough teeth to actually institute those machinations of accountability, or will it be another, like you said, public protector? Will it be another auditor general? Will it have prosecutorial powers? Will it have reform powers, right? Ability to actually make recommendations for reform, and that they not end on the president's desk, that they actually be instituted. How independent will this organization be? That's one of my concerns. But I absolutely agree with you. I think until we deal with institutions that facilitate corruption, which virtually every country that is Institute that has moved away from a tribalistic, government style to a more impersonal democratic system, it's they've all had to move away from patronage systems to merit-based systems, for examples, because we're trying to identify how corruption penetrates a government and how we can take the sting out before we even get to dealing with corruption elements within a government. Just creating those institutions and those systems that make sure that corruption is kept at bay, such as a merit-based system. But I'm unfortunately weary when I think whether there's political will to actually do that. I think we're beholden to certain ideology, and I'm quite concerned about the real powers that will be given, if any, to this office of integrity.
I will add two words for now. I do think the Hemingway principle of bankruptcy applies. How do you become bankrupt? Very slowly, and then all of a sudden. And paradigm collapse of the dominant ideologies and dominant political interests, how do they collapse? Slowly and then suddenly.
Final words. I will take those as the final words. Thank you so much, Herman, for a great discussion. Thank you for joining the Daily Friend Rap Show. We will be here same time tomorrow. It'll be me again hosting because Nicholas is away on leave, but he will be back on Wednesday. Until then, that's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.